Chapter 13. On the 10th, 11th, and 12th days, we had almost continual squalls. At last, we filled our water bottle, which held enough to keep our throats wet sparingly for a day or two. After this mean ration was safely stored, we found that the blessing of rain could turn into a curse. We had no means of saving more water than the little rubber bag would hold. The rest that fell was worse than wasted, for we had to bail it out of the boat. Worst of all were the tricky waves that squalls brought. These bounding hillocks of seawater kept dumping heavily into the raft. Thus the weather we had prayed for now became a threat to our lives. We had no implement for bailing. However, we did an adequate, if not satisfactory, job by taking off all our clothes, sopping up the water in the boat, and then wringing our dripping garments over the side. During this operation, we were continually in each other's way, which added no little to our irritation. Time after time, we would no sooner get the boat free of water than a high green comber would curl down upon us, half filling the boat with churning foam and pushing down the side on which it hit until I thought we would surely capsize. But the boat always rebounded with a sickening rock to the opposite direction, sending our cargo of seawater whirling about our knees as if it had been given one violent stir with a giant whipping spoon. The danger of losing our footing in the overpowering tumult and plunging into the writhing sea struck us with a dread that seemed to stop the blood in our veins. We exchanged no words at these times, but alternately held and bailed. It was as well. We could not have heard each other in the threshing tempest. Here we had the feeling, for the first time, of being hand to hand against the sea. There was no time to think of hunger. That gnawing pain was now becoming part of us, and we paid it heed only when there was no more immediate worry on our minds. Right now we were fighting a physical, bruising battle for our lives. The almost constant bailing, added to the considerable exertion required merely to keep ourselves inside the heaving raft, was drawing heavily upon our waning strength. I feared the storms were using the energy and stamina that was all we had to live on. When the last lashing rain left our boat behind, it was with great relief that we fell against the thwarts exhausted and lifted our haggard faces to the sun. On the 12th day, the sea was still rough, with the choppy surface showing white caps as far as I could see. During my watch in the morning, I sat on the forward thwart, scanning the glaring blue water for anything that might affect us, the while noting ruefully that my sunburnt face, which had been relieved in the cloudy days, was growing hot again. Suddenly, well ahead, I saw something strange bobbing in the water. I tried to see it again, but it had gone behind a wave. In a moment it reappeared. It looked brownish. We were bearing down upon the object, and I stood up to watch more closely. As we drew nearer, I saw that it looked like the nose of a seal. That's strange, I thought. What in the world is a seal doing in this place? I was familiar with seals, having watched them off the west coast many a time. I thought it was odd that I should encounter one in this far latitude. Well, I mused, live and learn. The closer we approached, the more the thing began to look like a seal. I couldn't think of anything else. The round brown thing obviously was not a fish. Although it bobbed, it kept more or less the same position in the water. I thought perhaps the seal was afraid of some large predatory sea denizen and was coming up frequently for air as it watched its enemy. In a moment we were abreast. Then I was puzzled again. If this is a seal, I thought, it should be frightened by the boat. Why doesn't it dive or swim away? Suddenly something flashed in my mind. I whipped around, looked hard, and half rose, then sat down again and cursed. I turned to Jean. "See that thing way out there?" I asked, pointing. His eyes picked it up. "Yeah," he said slowly. "What is it?" "Does it look like a seal?" I asked. Tony was in on the game by now. "Seals don't belong down here," he declared. "If it ain't a seal, what is it?" Gene demanded, having convinced himself by now. "Well, maybe it could have got away from home," Tony admitted. Having gained my support now, I put an end to it. "Well," I said, "listen, if there was room in this boat, I'd let you kick me for a damn fool. That was no seal, fellas. Damn it, it was a coconut." That left them with their mouths open. I have never in my life felt more provoked at myself, and I'd never felt so hungry as I reflected bitterly that I'd as good as thrown a heaven-sent meal in the ash can. "Aw, hell, don't take it so hard, Chief," Tony said. "Where there's one, there's others." "Sure, Chief," Gene said. "There's more where that came from." After that, we kept a coconut watch, made it part of the lookout's job. Tony had had no chance to clean the gun during our 3-day rain, and it had now deteriorated very badly. The gun was wet continually from rain and sea, and the salt water particularly had speeded corrosion. When dry weather came, Tony went to work at once. He chipped off thick rust and polished the corroded parts as best he could, but the automatic mechanism was beyond repair. The gun would no longer reload itself. He got it working after a fashion, however. We could put one slug in the barrel, force the slide back to the lock position, and fire one round. Then we had to pull out the empty cartridge by hand and shove another in, a tricky and laborious process and worrisome since we could see that we were soon to lose our pitiful armament, such as it was. The gun was in this condition when I shot the shark.